Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today I am pleased to welcome Craig Wischner onto the program. Craig is the managing partner of Farmland LP, a fund that serves as a great model for sustainable business. Craig and his team acquire conventional farmland and convert it to organic, sustainable farmland for the purpose of long-term cash flow and capital appreciation. Now, I first met Craig a number of years back, and that was when his farmland fund owned about 154 acres of farmland, and now it manages over 2,000 acres and is going to be expanding to over 6,000. And I'm really pleased that we here at Peak Prosperity were able to direct accredited investors to that initial fund, and that we do have a business relationship with Farmland LP, because we really do believe in it. I've since watched with excitement the success he and his partner Jason Bradford have had in making it a real and thriving enterprise. On Peak Prosperity, we talk a lot about the need for new models of doing business that will comport well within the growing economic, energetic, and environmental constraints bearing down on all of us. I believe Craig and his team are setting a great example, and I get a boost of optimism about our future knowing that there are innovators like them out there blazing a trail for others to follow. Craig, thanks so much for joining me today. I'm really excited to hear about the latest updates and what you and your team are up to.
Very glad to be here.
First off, describe Farmland LP, the business model, for our listeners who might be unfamiliar with it, and the factors that led you to pick that model and to believe it would work.
Great. Well, you did a great job in the intro. Farmland LP buys conventional farmland, converts it to organic, sustainable farmland as an investment fund, actually very similar to a REIT, a real estate investment trust. So as we raise capital, we buy farmland, and the investors have the benefit of owning this tangible, appreciating asset over a long period of time. And farmland, like other forms of real estate, generates cash flow. And the cash flow can be delivered in perpetuity over time if it's managed sustainably, and that's actually what we specialize in. So we specialize in buying great farmland at great prices that's generating good cash flow, and then adding value to that farmland to increase the cash flow. And we add value in two primary ways. The first way that we do that is by converting it to certified organic farmland, which is a three-year process. And then once it's certified organic, we can take advantage of the 50 to 200% price premiums for organic goods. Generates more revenue for the farmers, more income for the investors. The second thing that we do, which is actually the core and the heart of what we do, is we specialize in using sustainable agriculture best practices. And what that primarily looks like, particularly in the early period, is bringing in livestock back onto the land. And that livestock is both a higher value crop, so you generate more revenue per acre by having sheep and cattle and pastured poultry on that land for meat and for eggs. And the other benefit to that is that the animals leave behind a lot of fertilizer. And so after a 3 to 7 year conversion period, you've actually restored the farmland to its original very strong biologically fertile state, and it's perfect for bringing in certified organic farmers into the process. And that reduces their input costs, makes the farmers more profitable, and again, generates more revenue for the investors as well.
I love the idea. You know, we've had Joel Salatin on a couple of times. Am I wrong in assuming that the models that he's talked about that he uses at Polyface Farm are somewhat similar to the ones you're using here?
Yeah, Joel is great. Joel definitely gets the model. We look, you know, imagine what it would look like to actually scale up Joel's model to thousands and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of acres. And in essence, that's what you're talking about with Farmland LP's model.
Now let's talk about last year was a year of drought and great difficulty for a lot of farms. How did your operations fare during that?
Well, they fared actually extraordinarily well. First thing is we actually really take a long-term view when we're looking at buying farmland. We really look at buying properties that we want to own for 30 plus years. And so as part of that process, we use 20 major factors in identifying where to buy farmland and which pieces of farmland to buy. And one of those is looking at the climate models. And so the two areas that we have farmland in right now, Oregon, in the Willamette Valley in Oregon, and a certain part of Northern California, those were two areas that were not affected by drought. Whereas most of the other country, most of the rest of the country was. It was actually the largest natural disaster in U.S. history by land area, the drought was. The second point on that is that one of my favorite photos of the year was actually a picture of a droughted Indiana farm field that was in the Washington Post a few months ago. And it wasn't my favorite because the cornfield was droughted, but what was interesting was that between the droughted cornfield and the road was a bright green strip of grass. And that bright green strip of grass, here people were looking at this and saying, oh, it's an incredible drought condition, poor farmers. Well, why were the grasses so green? Well, there was actually plenty of water for the grasses because their roots go down 6 to 8 feet and more. Corn roots only go down 6 to 8 inches. So if they had planted more of a perennial crop rather than an annual crop, we would have produced a lot more beef, for example, in the Midwest than we did. And some people have this kind of this mistaken understanding about corn. They think it's incredibly productive. And the fact is, if you have a farmer who farms an acre of land in Iowa, and then ships off all the corn, does all the work, puts in all the fuel and the fertilizer and the pesticide and harvests all that corn, ships it to a feedlot. That feedlot will produce around 1,500 pounds of meat from the corn on that acre of land. If, however, that farmer planted a pasture in that land and put a cow on it, and they own the cow, they would also produce 1,500 pounds of meat from that grass. And, however, the farmer would, instead of just getting the value of the feed, they would also get the value of the cow. And that's really how agriculture used to be for as long as agriculture went on. Agriculture was having livestock and vegetable crops in a rotation on the land. Unfortunately, over the past 60 years, we've really geared towards just this monocropping system of corn and soy, and we've really destroyed a lot of the soil fertility, but we've also reversed basically 8,000 years of agricultural progress over the past 60 years.
So what I love here is there's a business model here that seems to make sense, that comports with the realities that we're currently talking about. So you mentioned here's a farmer that could grow 1,500 pounds of meat either way. But in your first example, which involves a lot of energy inputs to harvest the corn, grow the corn, transport the corn, do all of that. And the second one sounds a lot less energy intensive. So that sounds like there's also going to be some additional hidden value in there to not just the farmer, but to society at large. And so what I love about this is the idea that we can actually have business models that make sense, that make sense on ecological foundations and economic foundations and energy foundations. It just sounds great. So, question, are you a mission-driven organization then? Meaning, are you pursuing this work because of a philosophy, or is this simply a great ROI that you've discovered?
Well, Chris, you know, I don't think there's actually a very big difference between having a good long-term investment and having it be a sustainable investment. In fact, I think that only when you shorten your time horizon over very, very short periods of time is there some kind of trade-off. If you think about our minimum time horizon is 3 to 4 years. If you look at conventional agriculture versus organic and sustainable agriculture, the academic studies have actually shown if your time horizon is 4 years or less, then it makes sense to stay as conventional agriculture. But if your time horizon is 5 years or longer, then it actually makes better economic sense, better on a discounted cash flow basis, to convert to organic agriculture. And there's this somewhat false dichotomy that people have about their investment portfolios, that they have to get the best returns over the next quarter, the next quarter, the next quarter, but they've really forgotten that they're actually investing for events that are going to happen 10, 20, 30 years down the line. They're investing maybe for their kids going to college or for their retirement or possibly for something to pass on to their kids. And from that standpoint, you actually need to have good investments that will store value and appreciate over time, as well as deliver great cash flow over those periods. And when you look at the world that way, from a time period of your lifetime, then you want to invest in things that are going to be a source of durable value over the long haul, and also deliver good investment returns. And from that standpoint, from that view, farmland for us is a perfect asset class. You know, gold is a great store of value, but it doesn't deliver any cash flow. Oil is a wonderful source of cash flow, but it depletes over time. And we view farmland from a financial perspective as being kind of in this perfect middle world of having the durability of gold plus the cash flow of producing food over long periods of time.
I'm fascinated by this idea of how you would calculate returns on this particular investment. So, normally when we think of conventional investments, so there's the cash flow, that might be dividends, it might be interest, and then of course there's capital appreciation. We can just open up the newspaper and or go online and check the capital portion of our holdings. How is it that you go about calculating the return on investment or ROI of your fund for investors?
There's a little bit of a backstory. It's very simple to calculate the returns of our fund. We have an asset that appreciates over time, and we basically get income from rent, lease income from our farmers. And it's one thing that's really been interesting for me is that I'm 43 years old. I've had an investing career in both equities and tangible real assets. My family's actually owned and managed investment real estate since before I was born, so I kind of grew up in that world. But it's really extraordinary to me how stocks and stock returns have really been at the forefront of people's thinking about investments. There was a time not so long ago when stocks were these strange derivative instruments that people didn't understand. They wanted actually real tangible assets because they could understand owning an asset and generating rents and other returns from those real assets. And now the shifting has totally shifted so that people actually don't understand that the real value of actually owning cash flowing assets for the long haul. And that's really what we specialize in. So from an investment return perspective, normally farmland, you can go out and buy farmland today at a basically a 3.5 to 4% cash flow return to the asset, and that's based on conventional commodity crops. And what we do is we buy farmland, we convert it to organic farmland, and then use sustainable agriculture best practices. And what that basically looks like is that we'll buy 1,000 acres of land that may be growing corn today. And then my business partner, Jason, develops a land management plan, a sustainable agriculture management plan for that land. And really, if you're growing corn year after year on ground, it's really the worst thing for the land. You end up spending a tremendous amount of money on inputs, on fertilizers and pesticides, and you're losing topsoil, and you're spending a lot of money irrigating. And actually, after about 5 years of doing that, you're spending a lot more money on the inputs to grow those crops than you were if you had just managed it sustainably. Mm. And so we actually take it through that conversion process to kind of wean it off of the chemical dependency that it's on, and restore the soil carbon, restore the soil fertility. And we do that by planting perennial forages, basically pasture on corn quality land, and then bringing in expert sheep farmers and cattle farmers and pasture poultry producers who grow eggs and meat. And we actually get great economics even during the conversion period to it being certified organic farmland, and we're also restoring the soil fertility naturally. And then once that soil fertility has been restored over 3 to 7 years, then we rotate in the vegetable farmers. After 2 to 3 years, they've used up that soil fertility, and we rotate them onto the next piece of pasture. and bring in either a grain farmer or put it back in the pasture. So in this scenario, we're acting as the land managers. We're creating actually a tremendous amount of jobs for farmers to grow locally grown, organic, healthy food, and we're making better revenue. They're able to grow their businesses. So by bringing in these diversity of farmers, what we're actually doing is we're making sure that our agricultural practices and the farmers on the land are maximizing soil fertility from a biological standpoint. And by doing that, we're generating, you're starting out with the returns on conventional farmland, growing commodity crops, basically crops that compete solely on price. And we're adding premiums to that. So we are, by getting it certified organic, our farmers are able to make extra revenue, and we have profit-sharing relationships with them, so we participate in that. By bringing on, instead of just growing one crop, we grow, we have a sheep farmer and a chicken farmer, basically on the same piece of land, very similar to how Joel Salatin does it. That generates extra returns. And the fertilizer that they leave behind is a really big benefit to the vegetable farmers, and they generate additional revenues and cost savings from that. And at the end of the day, we generate premium cash flow from the same acre of land simply by using much more sustainable practices. It really is a case where you get premium returns for doing the right thing.
Well, what are the impacts on the communities that these farms are serving at this point? What have you noticed happening there?
The farmers that we bring in, we work with some very experienced farmers, people who have been, for example, producing premium quality lamb for the past 30 years. Mm-hmm. We're able to provide them with much more acreage to produce these high-quality sheep than mm-hmm. they otherwise would have been able to afford. And, in fact, there's not a lot of wonderful land out there, high-quality land, that's specifically geared towards pastured production of meats. Mm-hmm. And yet this is the area that you get the highest price premiums on and is also in the most demand. So the farmers that we're working with, we're also working with a young farming family who's building a pastured egg production business. And we have some housing, some houses on our properties, and so we're able to lease this family a house and really help bring into fruition a dream that this family has been working on for a long time, to create a pastured egg production business at scale using sustainable agriculture best practices and really as part of a community on this farmland. So it benefits these young farmers, giving them access to farmland. It benefits the large farmers by helping them scale up their businesses even more. It benefits the community by producing more locally grown food. And really, the demand for locally grown organic food has really been expanding. Organic food has grown basically 16.5% per year since 1990. It's now over 4.5% of the food system, but only 0.7% of the farmland in the U.S. Is certified organic, and that's only growing at 8.5%. So you actually have this big disparity. There's a real big gap between the demand for organic food and the supply of organic farmland to grow that food. And so we really help kind of restoring the balance, and the communities really have a tremendous demand for this food, and it's really, at the end of the day, it's strengthening communities.
Food quality and security are two big issues in my household, and I was just reading, I guess it was maybe 2 months ago, in New York Times Sunday Magazine, they had a whole article in their food section about the Central Valley of California, and the summation of that was multiple farmers told this author, the journalists, that they knew they were farming in unsustainable ways, but felt locked into the paradigm, and it was very difficult to get out of. And the mysterious part about this to me is that we do find people such as yourself have found a way to step outside of that. There are lots of farming operations, Joel Salatins, that have stepped outside of it. It seems to be working, and yet a lot of people feel locked. It's almost like they're two completely parallel universes, and it seems difficult for people to figure out how to get from point A to point B. But as you mentioned, over here at point B, a lot of demand, high quality food, people are interested in that. And so I'm wondering if you have some advice. We have a lot of interest among our community for sustainable business models in general, particularly in a net energy constrained world. So do you have any advice or specific criteria that you could share on how folks might go about evaluating, identifying what you would consider to be a good business model in this world?
Yeah, well, I think that was extraordinarily well said. There are some very specific barriers that separate these two universes of agriculture. And one is this commodity-based form of chemical-dependent agriculture that's really been only in place from the 1950s when artificial fertilizers, when cheap, essentially free artificial fertilizers, mm-hmm. Came into play. And really for thousands of years before that, you had tremendous diversity in crop rotations. Actually, in 1950, the average farm produced 5 crops per farm per year. So that includes livestock, vegetables, grains, in sustainable rotations. If you look at that number today, we've gone from 5 crops per farm per year to 1.2 crops per farm per year. We have almost a perfect monocrop system all across the United States. And that was really dependent based on these cheap inputs. And really over the past 20 years, what's happened is that assumption that those inputs are cheap and essentially free, that's actually shifted. It's actually now more cost-effective, more profitable to produce grass-fed meat than it is to produce the corn grain-fed meat. So there's been actually a shift in the economic system, but unfortunately we have basically 60 years worth of investment that's gone into these monocropping systems. As farmers got more successful, they would simply buy larger equipment for planting and harvesting corn, and so we're left with this huge built environment. Unfortunately, the average age of farmers today is 60 years old. So these people have really been farming under the system the whole entire time, and they have all the equipment, and they have usually debt on their plate, and they're simply not making the transition. And so what we generally do is we look for farmland. We buy farmland from the farmers who are retiring or dying, and it's in their estates, and then we take it through that conversion period. And it's really just a 3 to 5 year conversion period. There's a lot more complexity. You're talking about going from a farmer who may be producing corn on 1,000 acres with a certain set of equipment to really having multiple farmers on the land producing multiple kinds of crops on the land. And it takes management, it takes expertise to take it through that conversion period. But that end state, that, as you said, that alternate universe, is actually a fully functional, thriving universe that's proven scientifically and economically and agronomically for thousands of years. And it's incumbent on the communities to figure out how to fund that transition. And it involves changing the management of the land. It involves funding the farmers to invest in livestock, and involves the community buying those products to help with that transition. It may seem like a little bit of faith at first, but if you break these things down into their little components, investing in farmland, investing in good farmers, and buying sustainably produced local food, you're really talking about things that deliver wonderful economic benefit and community benefit as well. And this is really the vision for what agriculture can be again in the future.
I think it's fascinating that you mentioned that basically in the 1950s where things really shifted. I believe the first supermarket in the United States was 1947. So we're really talking about the way most people think this is just how farming is actually a very recent invention, sort of a maybe possibly even a diversion from what farming used to be and will be again. And so to get from point A to point B, though, this is the really fascinating thing where I think we need business models like the ones you're talking about, because it does take support. I'm a big fan of saying that we have to enable and embolden our young people to make a lot of mistakes as we try and figure out how to navigate from a high energy society to a slightly lower energy society. That's not an easy transition. We don't have any history books to really guide us. So guess what? We're going to have to make a few mistakes in there. And I was really taken this year when I visited an 11,000 acre corn operation. It was in Maryland, of all places. And the average age of the two farmers running it was well above your 60 mark. And when I queried, you know, were their sons or daughters getting involved? And they said no. They almost laughed about it, because here they were running this operation, which nominally had millions of dollars in revenue every year. They were running at about $150 per acre profit. And it doesn't take much to wipe out $150 of profit. The margins were, I think they were running at maybe 2%, maybe 3% based on current land pricing. So if you're thinking about coming into that as a young person, I can't imagine wanting to step into that farming operation with that much risk, that much responsibility, that little amount of reward, but also knowing that it's fundamentally unsustainable. That's not the kind of thing that really compels young people to jump up and say, yeah, sign me up. Maybe that's part of the trend here.
That's exactly right. And also, how did they come up with all the capital just to buy the farmland to get started? The agricultural system that we have today is based on the same, essentially, game that created the modern financial system, which is requiring literally trillions of dollars worth of bailouts. It's actually hilarious. Ben Bernanke basically saying that he's going to print money until the employment situation improves is something that's almost funny to me. It just makes absolutely no sense at all. And yet this is the paradigm of the leaders of the politicians and the economic system that we have today. Agriculture is basically driven by those same factors that have resulted in the economic system. And the fundamental mismatch that really put agriculture on the course where we are today is viewing agriculture as a chemical-based system as opposed to a biological-based system. That phrase, I was driving around with Bill Nyman yesterday. Bill Nyman founded Nyman Ranch in the mid-70s, built that up to a $60 million business, left about half a dozen years ago. It's the largest natural meat company, ethically produced meat company in the U.S., and he's now started a new company, BN Ranch. Bill's an advisor of ours. I'm on his board of directors. He's just an absolutely extraordinary guy and very wise. And he was talking yesterday, used the phrase, better living through chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
When nitrogen was low in people's fields after the war, they basically took this ammonium nitrate explosive, put it on the fields, and increased crop productivity. And then they were also fertilizing the weeds as well. So they said, oh, now I have this weed problem. Well, let's put this herbicide on them and kill the weeds. Okay, great. Well, now you have 1,000 acres of corn. Well, now all the pests that like to eat corn are eating the corn. Great. Well, let's spray insecticides, more chemicals. Now we have these herbicide-resistant weeds. Well, let's genetically engineer the crops to be able to tolerate more herbicide. And you end up with this very focused, very methodical, and somewhat an effective system over a short period of time where you view agriculture as a chemical-based system. And that works until the inputs are not cheap, and until the soil carbon has been burned down, and you've really rid the environment of its life and vitality. And you can switch it back around. It just takes time, and it just takes investment. Fortunately, the economic factors at play actually say that sustainable agriculture is much better economically now than the unsustainable agriculture that we have in place today. It's just going to take 30 years of investment in order to transition back. And I do think it's important that we transition as fast as possible, just in case there are any energy or supply or climate issues that we have in play, that may happen over time. We don't have a Ben Bernanke to print more food for us or print more farmland. And so it's really incumbent on the agricultural system to build up those reserves in the form of soil carbon and sustainable agriculture practices before we need it. Because, when the Hurricane Sandy hits, you can't buy insurance as the storm's on your doorstep. You have to get it in place ahead of time.
And we know all of these pressures in terms of world food production needing to increase because of we're heading to 9 billion people. We know that soil is being depleted, if not outright lost. We know that water itself is becoming an extraordinary issue. There are a lot of issues out there. And it sounds like the model that you're running is one way that we could address that. And we really ought to be having, I'm really glad you're doing what you're doing and that it's approaching thousands of acres. And dare I say, it needs to be millions and millions of acres to really provide that security you're talking about. So I'm fully in support of it. Craig, I'm interested. What are some of the most important lessons that you could share with us that you've learned being in being a sustainable entrepreneur, if I could use that term.
You can use it. So, you know, we have there's a socially responsible ratings organization called B Corp, and we received the highest B score ever. We didn't set out to do that. We really focused on building a business model that just delivered on its fundamental returns, owning a stable cash flowing asset and increasing cash flow by using agronomic best practices, sustainable agriculture best practices. And, you know, that's what we go to work and do every day. The reasons why we did it, I really had a big shift when my daughter was born. And really the moment that she was born, just had what again, Bill Nyman calls a parental epiphany, where my life was now about helping her dreams come true and really the dreams of everyone in her generation. And I really asked myself, what am I doing to make a difference 20 years from now for the world that we're going to give them? And that's what that time frame and wanting a world that works is really what drives us every day. And I think the lesson for entrepreneurs in this is that if you're going to be an entrepreneur, you have to start with a fundamentally good business model. And you're only going to be working on things that are really going to make a difference for you and your world in the future. And it really requires more from the entrepreneur, more thinking about building their business model, more thinking about how they're going to do it step by step and grow their business, and always keeping a focus on what are the metrics in addition to the financial metrics that they're going to make a difference on.
When you started this, would you say that you had a lot more explaining to do because it was an alternative business model, or did you find the reception was warm from the get-go?
It's interesting. You know, the reception was very warm. Most people don't have a familiarity with real estate, let alone farmland investing. And so most of the explaining is just around, some people say, well, you know, how can you make any money in farmland? And what they don't know is that 40% of farmland in the U.S. is leased today, and that it is just it's a cash flowing asset, just like an apartment building or an office building or one of the timber REITs. And we are thinking about it, I would say, slightly differently than people have thought about farmland in the past, where it's been one farmer owns one piece of land growing one kind of crop, and that's resulted in the agricultural system that we have today. To us thinking about farmland a little bit more like an office building, where you have a group that owns the asset, like an office building, like a REIT, a group that manages that asset, like we manage farmland using sustainable agriculture best practices, and then tenants in there. You know, I run a business, and we rent office space. And if I need office space, I just rent more office space. I don't have to own this office building and deal with the headaches of that. I just get to rent office space. But we actually have an agricultural system where we force farmers essentially to buy a new office building every time they want to expand their production. And then take it through a 3-year, if they're organic farmers, we force them to take it through another 3-year organic conversion process before they can actually sell the crops that the market demands. If they're successful, let's say they double their acreage, you know, if they're successful, they're going to sell everything that next year, and then what are they going to do? Well, they have to go out and buy more farmland. Really gigantic burden that we've put on organic and sustainable farmers. What we do is, you know, we buy the land, we take it through that conversion process, and then provide the highest quality land at a large scale and on a very low-risk basis to successful farmers to grow crops that you and I and lots of people all want to eat. So, you know, that's actually the role that the investors get to play in helping transition this. They're really transitioning the land use out of the commodity, chemical-based agriculture system into this organic, sustainable agriculture system where you have much more, many more farmers on a piece of land in a rotating basis. It works very well.
Well, that's fantastic. Craig, what are your plans for the future? I hear wind that you have another fund coming out potentially in 2013. Is that right?
That's right. So this fund is closing at the end of Q1 next year, and this will be 6,300 acres and $42 million worth of farmland. And then towards the second half of next year, we're going to open up a second fund, and that'll be a brand new pool of farmland.
Oh, fantastic. Looking forward to that. And how should those who might be interested in learning more about your operations, how would they go about doing that?
Welcome to look at our website at farmlandlp.com. They can also email us. I'm at craig@farmlandlp.com. And we're glad to send them information. This fund right now is open to accredited investors, and there's a $500K minimum at this point, just due to SEC requirements that is being limited to 99 investors. We have 67 investors right now. Next year's fund, though, will be a much lower minimum again.
Fantastic. Also, we do have a link provided at the bottom of this podcast where you can just click on that, email us, and we will get you in contact as well. So with that, I really, really admire what you've done, and thank you for taking the time to share some of your insights and the learnings. And the thing I like most about this is that often people ask, they feel powerless, like what could we possibly do? The trends are all heading in the wrong direction. And the answer is that, in fact, there are lots of things we can do that we can do today that make sense. They make economic sense. They make ecologic sense. They make energy sense. And by the way, that's how all investments going forward, those are the filters I apply now. If they don't make sense on all three of those dimensions, they probably don't make sense in the long term. And by the way, for me, that's what an investment is. It's an investment in the future. So thank you for showing us a way that we can invest in the future and that it's possible.
Great talking with you as always, Chris.
Thanks.